Now, let's welcome tonight's speaker, Louise C.
I'm Louise and I'm an alcoholic. I hope I didn't mess up the tape. Anyway, okay. I'm Louise and I'm an alcoholic, and I want to thank Denny for having me here tonight, and it was fun to walk in and see a lot of people that I know, and thank you for your warm welcomes. Okay, let me synchronize my watch so I'm not kicked out at the last minute. My sobriety date is August the 8th, 1993. I don't know why that is my sobriety date, because there were many other reasons prior to that, God, it was a good idea, she ought to get sober, you know, and change her life. But it was just that little window that came that morning, and I just, though that pathway, and I just followed it, and I want to keep it. So I just do whatever is asked of me. I do a lot of what I don't feel like doing. I take a contrary action, and as a result of that, you know, my life is pretty balanced out, and it feels good. I was, I grew up down in Venice with my mom, and it was just the two of us, and she was Scottish, she was from Glasgow, and she had a really thick Scottish accent, and she sat on the edge of the sofa, she drank, she knitted really fast, she watched TV, she drank really tall drinks, and talked on the phone, and took sleeping pills and could never sleep. So this was like her routine. And I sat on the shag carpet in front of the TV and played with all my Barbie dolls. I just loved my Barbie dolls. And I just got rid of them about 3 years ago. And I sent them down to Mexico because I have a stepdaughter, and God forbid she's going to be playing with those, you know, because I get a little jealous still sometimes. So I just, I don't want her playing with Tuesday Taylor and spinning her head around. And so anyways, I sent them somewhere else. But you know, I was just this shy, quiet little girl, and my mom, she just adored me. She just wanted to love her daughter, and I was always presentable. She just always had me on display, and my friends would come over. We had a lot of kids in our neighborhood, and they would come over, and they would say, "What is she saying?" And I would translate. My mom would do this kind of thing, you know, take me in the other room, and she says, "What the bloody hell are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm translating. They don't understand you." And she goes, "It's bloody English. You could tell them to get out ahead." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, you know, it's already starting." And they just asked, you know, "Can I have some water or something?" I mean, it's just weird. So anyways, that's just how it was. And so I enjoyed going over to your house, and I didn't care, you know, if your dad was beating your mom. I mean, I felt bad for her, but I didn't ask any questions. I was a really good friend. Because I didn't want you asking questions when you came over to my house. Like, "Where's your daddy?" Because, honey, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. We can ask a lot of questions in our house, so you couldn't ask. If you can't ask what's for dinner, you can't ask, you know, "Who's my daddy?" And I just knew, you know, you got to be quiet around Sadie, because she's got to just stay, you know, calm and smooth. So there were a lot of Scottish people and Irish people that were in our little neighborhood, and the ones that are still alive still live in their little homes down there in our old neighborhood. And every Saturday night I would watch my mom get ready. She was always wallpapering and fixing up the house and stuff, and we shared this bedroom, and it was all that white furniture from Sears with the little gold on it and stuff, and the canopy bed, and we had these big floral wallpaper all over and stuff, and she put Engelbert Humperdinck on the radio and her album, and she'd have her tall, you know, her highball and stuff, and this was like in the 70s, she put on that, you know, blue eyeshadow and do her hair. She was very tall and blonde, and she had beautiful blue eyes, and she wore those long kind of gowns that women wore in the 70s and stuff, and Engelbert's singing, and she's drinking her highball and smoking her cigarettes and putting on all her makeup and doing her hair in the French twist and stuff, and we had one of those on the dresser, the styrofoam head, you know, with her little hair piece on it and stuff. It's just picked up from the hairdresser that day, you know, because she's, you know, it's Saturday night, party night and stuff, and anyways, then she'd finish her drink, she'd go over, you know, she'd get the little hair piece on, we'd be really quiet, you know, so it was on, you know, super steady and straight and stuff, and put all the pins in and go to that tall can of Aquanet and just lacquer the whole thing up and stuff. I still have a bad cough, you know, with that today, and I'm convinced it's her fault, you know, and it was on the first four step. Anyway, so all that. When they said let loose on that fourth step, I did. Everything, you know. Sean Starr is stealing my first Barbie doll, you know. I kicked that kid every chance I got. And it felt good. And I didn't have a drink yet, but that's how it felt. It felt good. So, and then when my second sponsor said, you're a bully, I thought, how? A nice girl like me, how could I be a bully? And anyway, so, you know, my mom would finish getting all ready. She'd put on her little Estee Lauder Youth Dew perfume, and she'd look over at me, and she'd go, right, come on, we're going over to the party. And, you know, all the Scottish and Irish people would take turns, you know, at each other's houses and stuff. And someone would bring a microphone like this, or a little speaker, and a drum or two sticks, and that was Uncle Mike, and he was the band. They called him the band. And then everybody brought their own big bottles, and they'd have their names on them, and their record player, their little records with their names on them and stuff. And they just have a good time, and you go around and hug and kiss all your aunts and uncles, because my mom would say, you know, we're all related through the drink, and those are aunts and uncles, and it just made sense. So I had one aunt, my mom's one youngest sister that was in this country. She's the only one that came here besides my mom, and that would be there too. And anyways, they would tell stories, and the microphone would go around and sing their songs and stuff. And when Auntie would sing her song, she was like a little teaspoon drunk, you know, just a little bit, and she's gone. I mean, she's gone. It's like a shame. What a waste, you know. And it's like suffering to watch her, like, try to drink. And then she's singing, you know, Stella by Starlight, and she wanted to be a performer. And her teeth would come flying out. And the Scottish people just had a bad time with teeth. And so, you know, and Uncle Mike would do the sticks on the drums, and he'd say, Dunny move, Ina's lost her wallies. And that's teeth. And so then he'd go, ooh, Dunny move, the Doug's got him, the dog's chewing on him, like a ride in the corner. And stuff. And my aunt's very feisty, even at like 80. She's 83 today. She's still feisty. And still has that dream of being a performer. I don't disappoint her. And so if she ever wants to sing, I let her. But I kind of, you know, you got to watch it if the teeth are going to fall out. But anyway, so she would just get them and dunk them in someone's drink and put them on and finish her song. And so anyways, and people just got over that real quick, and then my mom would sing, and they just all were very happy people until like it was like 2 or 3 in the morning and someone mentioned the Pope. And we weren't Catholic, the rest of them were, so I thought the Pope, I really thought it was a bad word, because nothing good came out of anybody saying something about the Pope. They would just kind of look at each other, and the eyes would go, and it would get real quiet, and then you'd hear the Irish one go, ah, Jesus, Mary, Bloody Joseph, there's going to be a fight, and then boom, you know, it started. And they're outside, and my mom's out there hitting men. It's the only time I ever saw her have contact with a man. It's just, you know, God, now I know she must have had some resentments going. And all the little Al-Anon aunties are, you know, they got the kettle on, stack of sandwiches like that. And just trying to get everybody in. All the kids want to be outside and watch because it's the action and stuff. And the next day, everybody comes and helps clean up, and they're all friends again. It's just the way they roll. You know, they were just that like that. And they're very supportive. Like if someone was going, I remember we were going to Scotland a lot, and the whole, they would all caravan and take you to the airport. And when you were coming home, they would all be there because you can go to the gate then and stuff. And they were just like this sweet little community that had its quirks. And anyways, I was about, I don't know, 13, 14. It was summertime. And my friend Joanne and I heard about a band that was going to play in a backyard in Venice, and we thought, well, we better go because now we're getting into boys and stuff, and I just had a thing for guys with really long hair and all that. And anyway, so I picked her up on my cruiser, and we ended up at a liquor store. Someone bought us two bottles of Boone's Farm, and then I don't know if we went in an alley behind Bush, what we did, but I cracked that bottle open. I didn't know what it was. But it was a nice size, and that made me kind of happy. And then I just started drinking that Boone's Farm, and it didn't taste that great, but I just loved the feeling instantly that it produced in my body and how it just, what it did to my brain, and I just felt so happy. And Joanne's spitting it up. She's gagging. She's only got the neck down. I felt so sorry for her. And because it was clear that it wasn't doing anything for her, but it was doing a whole heck of a lot for me. Anyway, so I finished her bottle, and for some reason she got on the handlebars and let me drive the bike after two balls of Boone's Farm. But anyway, so we made it to that party. I don't remember much, but I remember, like, you know, meeting this guy, and he was this drummer in another band, and he was a lot older than me. And anyway, so you know, I don't know if it was a few days later when it was, he comes cruising along on his bike, and I'm all ready to go out, and my mom's looking out her curtains going, "You're not going out with that now?" And he had this long, scraggly hair, these bandanas, these, you know, he just looked like a scruffy thing, and I loved it. And I thought, you bet I am. So I got out there, I jumped on those handlebars, and we went down Lincoln Boulevard to Joe's Liquor, and he said, "Okay, wait out here." And I did, and he came back out. And there, he had a big brown bag, and he said, "Hold on to this." And I thought, okay, you know, and I looked inside, and it was a big bottle. It was clear, and it said 151. And I didn't know what that was, but I just thought, wow, okay. And it's big, so I got excited. And then there was a 2-liter bottle of Coke, a bag of ice, and so romantic, 2 cups upside down on the neck. And I just thought, you bet I will. I just got really excited. I thought, you bet I'll hold on to this. And then the way we went down Lincoln Boulevard, you know, up Superba to Penmar, and I thought, oh, my God. I remember summertime, you know, it's just, you know, sun's just going down from the day, and I'm holding on to this. I can smell his hair kind of whipping in the wind, you know. And I thought, oh, I have no idea where we're going, but I thought, wow, what a lucky girl am I. I'm going on a date. I'm so excited. I'm so thrilled. And I didn't even know, like, what, you know, no, my mother never sat me down and told me what a date, you know, what you do or whatever. Anyway, so we end up at Penmar Park, and he pulls up, you know, to a bench and takes the bag from me and starts pouring some drinks. And, gosh, I just loved it. I didn't know, like, what was going on. But a ton of kids show up, and it was kind of like those places you start where you're going to, you may even end up there, or I go right into a blackout. It's like the Dream of Jeannie show. Blink, ooh, okay, here I am. You know, blink, ooh, I'm talking to you. You know, blink, oh, now we're at the beach, and you're not my boyfriend. Like, what happened? You know, like the scene and the people have changed. And but I never cared. It seemed kind of exciting, you know, just go with it. And that's what I did. You know, I always was coming out of blackout. And I came out of blackout, I was blonde. I had no idea how that happened. And I got out of the shower, and I was just at the beach all day. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, I was just blonde. And then it turned orange, and I had to shave it all, you know, just really cut it short and stuff. And it was that super sun-in, if any of you remember that from the 80s. And it says, you know, you spritz it in, it enhances your natural highlights. So I poured the whole bottle on, somebody told me, on my head. I was out there in the sun all day. And, you know, I just do weird stuff like that. And just, you know, I came out of blackout once. I was in a golf cart, and it was nighttime. And I thought, ooh, I didn't know you can golf at night. You know, I was, like, really, like, confused. Like, do these things, like, glow in the dark? Or, like how do you do? And we're not even at a golf course. It's a parking lot. Like, I was really confused. But that's the thing. You can't let them know that. That was always those secrets. Can't let them know that. I got to just act like, you know, oh, yeah. And the guy's like, do you see it? And I'm thinking, I guess I'm looking for a golf ball. You know, I was just so weird. And it was like, it didn't click till later. You know, I had been at a concert, and I lost my car, and the guy's driving me around, you know, on this thing. So it's just, but to connect all those dots, it's so confusing, because you can miss days and not even know, like, what the heck? And so I could be talking about something that happened 3 days ago, and they're like, no, you're here now or something. And it's, like, really weird. So it was awful confusing, but it was very exciting to me to always be drunk and be in a blackout. It was so exciting to me, but it wasn't to my mother, I can tell you that. She would... She started just, you know, locking the doors at night. She didn't want me in. Oh, do you need something? Oh, is there a doctor here?
I'm a nurse, and we're calling 911.
Okay. Okay. Where are we? Does he need... Keep going. Okay, so... Should we say a prayer? Okay. All right. Well, okay. Maybe we should just have a moment of silence and say a little prayer. Okay? Let's bow our heads and do that, please. Okay? Okay. Danny? I have a water, if you need water. This hasn't been opened. Go ahead. Okay. All right. We'll try to do the best we can here. I feel bad. Okay. So alcoholism took me down really quick, but I just kept going. When I was 15, my mother, I came home one day because she started double bolting the doors and wouldn't let me in. I would stay away for weekends. I love going down Ensenada. You can forget about stuff down there, you know. You come back with a whole set of new problems, but you can forget about everything, all the ones going on your way down that you've got. And I remember coming out of a blackout. I knew I was down there, but I came out of a blackout. It was morning. You know those mornings you'd come to, and like your head is pressed against something? It's either sand, dirt, grass. You know, those sharp blades are horrible. And, or, you know, this time it was something hot. It was hot metal. And I came to, and I felt the sun beating on my face. And it was hot metal, and when I looked around, I was in the back of a pickup truck in an alley, and I have no idea how I got there. I had no idea, like, nothing. But I never, like, stopped to kind of try to figure it out. It was like, I got to get out of here and get going, you know, because who knows who's going to come back if someone, I didn't know what happened. And still to this day, I don't. There are a lot of those things. And anyway, so, so my mom was... she was locking the doors and from the inside, so I couldn't get in. She had all new locks put on, and because I was harming her, and we weren't getting along at all. And I came home one morning. It was probably about, I don't know, 5 or 6 in the morning. She was sitting there, and she just took one look at me. I was 15 years old, and she said, "You can't live here anymore. You're just breaking my heart. I can't go through this anymore." And she probably did like the bravest thing a parent could do, is just like, you know, without having any Al-Anon, any tools in her, she just surrendered and said, "I can't live like this, and therefore you can't live here." And I called some people, and it took a few phone calls, and somebody took me in. And this family, I lived with them for a little while, and they were very kind to me. But I wasn't any different. I was still doing the same thing. And they, one day they came to me and they said, "You have to go. You know, our home has no harmony in it anymore. There's no peace here with you." And I remember I'd all scratch my head thinking, "What's wrong with these people? I just want to have a good time. You know, I'm a nice person." And like, what's their problem? You know, they're pretty boring. I mean, just had all this judgment. Is the time like I'm moving boxes and I'm the one that's homeless. And they're in their home, just comfortable. And then I lived with another family, and I lived there for a little while, and the same stuff was happening, and then they asked me the same thing, to leave. And I finally, I went back home. I didn't tell my mom that I had gotten removed from all those other homes, and she let me come in. And nothing was different. And we went to Scotland, we came back, and she was feeling really sick. And she went to the doctor, and she was diagnosed with cancer. And she died within 6 months. I was still drinking. That's when I wasn't coming home a lot. It was really embarrassing to ever admit what kind of daughter I was to my mother while she was dying. I thought I would never, ever tell anybody how I was. I never took care of her. I think I fed her once and I gave her one bath. I couldn't do it. I couldn't see any farther than here. It was all about me. I had so much going on in my head. I didn't know how to be of love and service until I came here and you showed me how to do that. I didn't know how to care for anybody. When I got sober, my mom died July 3rd, 1987, and it took me quite a number of years to get here. And when I got here on August the 8th, 1993, the woman who made the 12-step call on me said, you need to get commitments. And I didn't know, she was so excited about that, and I didn't know what that meant. Like, why are you so excited about me, like, picking up stuff off the ground? And she said, "That's how you're going to be sober. You're going to stay sober today because you thought of others. You cleaned up your meeting place. You've got a little job." And I just kept doing that. I went to like 2 and 3 meetings a day. I went to Women's Stag. She said, "It's really important to go to a stag." I did that. Oh, good, they're here. And so, anyways, and she said, "You have to go to a Women's Stag. Those women are going to get to know you, because if you can't get a hold of me, you've got a whole phone list of all these women, and they know you. And so it's not so hard to pick up the phone." And that's what I did, and those women saved me. You know, they were quite a crew of women. And then I would just tell myself whatever I was doing at the time, and And I was just, you know, I thought, okay, I'm sober. I haven't taken a drink like in, you know, 30 or 60 days. I should be fine now. You know, everything should be good. And it was, they would just laugh at me because I would say, like, why am I doing this? Like, I can't even go to the market. I get an anxiety attack. I mean, I go into a cold sweat. And this old timer, Gloria, she said, is that the same market you went to when you were drinking? And it's like, well, yeah, it's a market in my neighborhood. And she'd say, then you need to go to a different market. Even if you have to drive 5 miles away, go to a different market. And don't go through the liquor department. And, you know, she'd tell me all these tools for living. So, do you keep going? Keep going. Do you keep going? Okay. Right thing. What's that? Okay. Oh, well, thank God they came and got him really fast, you know. So, well, and he wasn't by himself. Anyway, so, okay. It just, anyways, when I came here to you, I was told a lot to get commitments. And I thought that that was a really weird thing to do, but I did it. I did it. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't want to go back to drinking. I wanted to be sober. And so I did whatever you told me to do. I went to a lot of meetings. I didn't like it. I wasn't happy. It wasn't like, oh boy, I'm going to go to a meeting tonight. But I couldn't wait to get to the meeting for this purpose. I wanted to hear whoever was sharing. I wanted to hear what you were like. I needed to hear that. I needed to relate to that. So then when you said what you were like today, you gave me hope. And then I could do the commitment, you know. In this women's day, we had this crew of women. There was Debbie. She was waiting. She wore a pager because she was waiting for a liver. And then she did the coffee. And it was just this little coffee, Mr. Coffee thing from CVS. And so they said, Louise, you better take on the coffee because if Debbie gets the call, so, you know, God forbid there's no coffee at the meeting, you know, you better take on that coffee. And I thought, oh my God, okay. And it was just this little crew of women, this round robin kind of meeting. So I went home with Mr. Coffee and I started practicing because, you know, it's all about me. That's what I do. And so I'm practicing, and it's making a lot of noise. You know, something's going on with this. It's broke. I just know it. And I always would call Debbie. They kind of assigned her to me. And I would call her, and I'm like, you know, Deb, I know you're waiting for a liver, but, like, I got a problem right now that needs an answer. Like, you know, so we need to focus on Wheezy now. And she would just laugh at the end of the phone. And I'm like, listen, it's making noise. You know, it didn't do this when you were making the coffee. She's like, well, yeah, because you weren't consumed with, you know, with me making the coffee because you're too busy thinking about yourself. And so anyway, she's like, don't worry about it. But it was just so weird, like those things that I would get so twisted up about, you know, just so twisted up. And And then I got, when I was about 3.5 years sober, I was really afraid I was going to drink again because it was sounding really good. I was breaking dishes in my house, and the feeling that I got from breaking those dishes was like a feeling after I cracked open a 12-pack of Mickey's Big Mouth, you know? It was just a good sigh, and I thought, that's coming next. I just know it. And so I called this woman I had met at a conference named Rita, and I went to, she was part of the Pacific Group, and so I went there, and she told me what meetings I was going to, what I was going to do, how early to get there. You know, she gave me this whole rundown of what to do, and I thought, oh my God, I drove away with what the heck did I get myself into? Oh my God. Well, I got to tell you, I just surrendered to her, and she saved my life. From 3 to 9 years of sobriety that I had, then she moved away and I got another sponsor, but she made me go through those steps again. She made me be of service outside of the room. So those commitments I had, I now had to take a commitment out into other areas of my life. She said, who is in your family that you could be of service to? And there was this lady, and I just want to tell you this story. And before I stop, and her name was Deary, and I knew her since I was 6 years old. And she was this little old lady, and she was like my adopted grandma, and I called her Deary. And the older she got, the littler she got, and she was just this cute little doll. I mean, she was the sweetest thing, and she drove this big old Lincoln Continental. All you saw was a little white poof at the top, you know, when she was driving down the street. She lived up in a big house in Malibu off the cliff. I loved going up there and just listening to the ocean. You know, we'd snuggle up at night and just hear the ocean. And she was like a dream, this little lady. And she loved Christmas. Like, she would come down, you know, from her house in her big Lincoln, and she'd have all these hefty bags. She was like, and I'd think, what the heck is in here? And it was like, look what Santa Claus is bringing, you know? And she was just so, she's like a little kid, just loved it. And Deary was getting older, and her daughter, who I call my Aunt Ruth, they just lived a few doors down from each other, you know, same place my mom and I grew up. And anyway, so I thought, oh, Deary, because, you know, Aunt Ruth probably needs help. So I called Aunt Ruth, and I said, can I come over and stay with Deary, and why don't you go out for dinner or something with a girlfriend? Because she was kind of like tied to having to take care of her. And all there was silence on the phone. And I thought, what's wrong? You know, oh my God, what am I doing wrong? You know what I mean? And I got to call Rita. And she's like, really? It's like, yeah. And so I did. I went down. She just went to a quick dinner. She was back an hour. And I think there just wasn't that trust, you know, for this. And anyways, so I always, I did it regularly, all the time. And before I knew it, Aunt Ruth's calling me, you know, I'm going to go to Palm Springs for the weekend. You know, you come down, take care of Deary. Fine. And now it's Italy for 2 months. You know, I mean, it became oh boy. And, but, you know, I loved it. I would stay at Aunt Ruth's apartment and take care of Deary during the day and at night and tuck her in. I'd get up in the morning and go down to see her because the night before, now I know how to make the coffee because you taught me. I had that woman's commitment at that stay. So I knew how I'd set up her coffee the night before and I'd have her little coffee cake and what she liked, I'd have it all set up for her. So in the morning I'd go in and she'd already eaten and drank her coffee and, she would be sitting watching TV and I'd go in and she would ask the same question over and over and over, like, where's Ruth? And I would think, I'm doing something wrong. You know, it's all personal. And I call Rita and I'm like, I'm doing something wrong. You know, she keeps asking for Aunt Ruth. She keeps asking me all these other, you know, she had short-term memory loss. And Rita, and I said, this is getting on my nerves. You know, I can't take this. And she said, you know what? You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're a sober woman today. You have to behave with love and service. You have to go in there, and when she asks that question, you have to turn your memory off that she's already asked that, and that this you have to react to her as if it's the first time she's asking this question, and give her the answer with joy and love. And I thought, oh my God, like what an order, you know? And so I thought, okay, you know, I can do this. And she said, and think about all those things this woman's done for you, because that switch goes off. You know, all the time in my alcoholism, that switch would go off. I wouldn't think about the kindness that people gave to me and the patience people had for me. And so I had to do that for Deary. And I'd say, okay, well, you should go, want to watch a movie? And I'd say, sure. And I'd say, okay, what do you want to watch? And because I knew the answer. And she said, put my John Wayne movie on, Donovan's Reef. We'd watch that sometimes 5 times a day, you know, through the night. Watch it over and over. And I watched it like it was the first time we were watching it and stuff. And then at night I'd make her dinner. I would run the bath, and I would give her a bath. She had her favorite little towel. I wash her back and just massage her, do her hair, and I would dry her all off, put her little pajamas on her, and I'd sit her in her chair, and I would do her nails and put lotion on her face, and she'd go, "Oh, this feels so good," and rub her feet and just pamper her, you know. And then this one night, you know, we're doing our same little routine, and I was sitting on the floor in front of her chair, and we're watching Donovan's Reef. And anyway, she's just, I had long hair at the time. She's just, you know, doing this with my hair, you know, rubbing it and stuff. And I looked up at her, and it was like all of a sudden, her memory, she was there. And she was looking right at me, and she'd said, "Your mama would be so proud of you today." And I was just like, whoa. That was like for me, that was like a spiritual experience completely. And I couldn't wait to tuck her in, to go back to Aunt Ruth and called Rita. And I told Rita about it. And I said, "I can't believe this, because you're saying to be of love and service to others, and I'm doing it, but I feel like I feel better. You know, like I'm getting the prize out of this whole thing." And she said, "You're just one of God's kids taking care of one of God's kids. You know, you're giving back, and that's what we learned to do here." And she said, and then she get that serious voice and say, "You know what, Louise, a drunk like you, you got to keep doing this stuff. You can't stop. You got to go, go, go." And so I've been going, going, going ever since. And anyways, I think that's my time. So I'm going to stop. Thank you. Okay, anybody have a question that I hope I have an answer to? Oh. What, how did I face that with in recovery? Oh, okay. Okay, the question was I knew that I never knew my father, and then how did I face that once I got into Alcoholics Anonymous? Right, okay. So, not well. Not well. I was very angry. I was very angry at my mother for never telling me. I got escorted out of the hospital when she was dying because she would not tell me. I was asked to not come back because I was bullying her, and she would not tell me, and my aunt would never tell me. And when I got to Rita and did another inventory, she had me write a letter of amends to my father. And I learned early on, you don't debate and you don't negotiate with yourself. I'm asking someone for their time, and it's somebody, obviously they have what I want. So in my head, I need to just surrender and have a little trust there. But I drove home thinking, didn't you remember? I don't know the man. Like, what amends do I owe here? But I thought, you know what? I'm just going to say a prayer, and I'm going to write this letter. And I still have it. I keep it on the side of my bed. And I just started off, "I don't know you," and I don't remember the whole thing. But it was. But as I got to the end of that, I realized I have held every man that has come into my life. Not on just going to the hardware store. Like, I will beat you up. I have held every man accountable that I have come into contact with for having a chip on my shoulder, for not knowing who my dad is. Like, I don't like it if you're nice. I don't like it if you're mean. I don't like it if you ignore me. I don't like it if you give me too much attention. Like, I just go crazy. And I saw that. And I had to go and read it to Rita. And she said, "Now every man is off the hook. And you have to continue to live like that." So you guys are lucky tonight, aren't you? Hey, you know, it's a good night in Brentwood. So I just, I had to live like that. And then she said, "And the other thing is, you can't live your life holding your fist up, wondering who it is, you know, what's the answer, you know, what is the whole deal? You have to let it go, and you have to pray to that on a daily basis." And I started doing that. And I just let it go. And my aunt and I were together. This was probably about maybe eight or 6 years ago. I don't remember. But we were down in Palisades. I had her helping me do a job, and we were coming home. And she said, "You know, you're never supposed to know this, but you're different. Like, I used to take her out a lot, and she would just start crying. And I'd say, what's wrong? Like, oh, my God, you have cancer, you're dying. You know, what's wrong? And she would say, you're just so different. I just don't, like, you're just so different. And you've just changed so much. And so that's what she said, you know, that night. You've changed so much, and you were never supposed to know this, but your mother was raped. And your mother came to us that morning, the next day, and we moved her in immediately. And we just took care of her. And she stayed. Her boss gave her the dignity of every morning coming to my aunt's apartment, bringing my mom her work. My aunt said I would help her do her work because your mom was very depressed and suicidal. And she said, but we did her work for the day, and your boss would take yesterday's work to work. Because in 1965, it just wasn't socially acceptable for a woman to have a child, and let alone be taken advantage of. And last Father's Day, I was on social media, and I saw everybody posting about their dads and pictures and all this stuff. And usually I would get so angry inside, and that wasn't happening. I thought, God, how nice, how lovely. Like, all these people have these memories of their fathers, and I felt happy for them. It was the first time I really felt that joy. And I wrote on there, you know, I've really enjoyed everybody's, you know, photos and stuff, and however, I never knew who my dad was. But I started thinking of men that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous who have stepped up to the plate and have taken sole custody of their children, my husband included, and have just followed a path and just raised their kids. And I started talking about, you know, how they're good men. And one of those, like, Scottish-Irish cousins private messaged me and said, you mean you don't know? Like, you really don't know? And I said, no, what are you talking about? And anyway, so it turned out we talked, and it was a man my mom worked with. It was a man that was married to another Scottish woman. It was really weird. And I knew him. I used to play with his children. I have siblings, and that I knew. I had pictures of them. I had no idea I had pictures of these people. And he's like, "Would you want to? Do you want to get in touch with them?" Like, now, you know, people get on that bandwagon and want to find the answer for you. And I'm just like, no, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't go. My first thought was, I don't go somewhere to walk into your life so to make me comfortable. And now I've wrecked your, you know, you don't, this is your dad, you know. So I'm just letting it be. And now I know. And this is the other weird thing. I found out there was a girl I went to high school with that we were actually friends, and she's my cousin. And it's just a trip. And I'm just going to leave it at that for now, you know, because if anything else, I feel like I'm forcing the will, and I can't live in that will today. I have to live in God's. So anyway, thank you for that question. I'm sorry for the long answer. Anybody else? Jerry.
Thank you so much. Sober is such a big adjustment from the life we lived before Alcoholics Anonymous. In your first 5 years of sobriety, were there any struggles that came to mind, and how did you deal with just the struggle of turning your life around so dramatically? Was your sobriety ever in jeopardy?
Yeah, when I would go to the market, because I love the alcohol, the liquor department, so that's why I had to go and find another market to shop at. But going to work was really hard, and I became very arrogant, I enormously arrogant at this. I worked for this man for, you know, many years, and I worked. It was a doctor's office. I worked in the front office. And sometimes I would show up there kind of drunk from the night before. I couldn't drive myself. My friend would have to pick me up and drive me. In fact, I knew Sam then. And he was one of our... Anyway, so I was so arrogant with this man. He ended up giving me an exit going away party and invited all the other doctor's offices that we dealt with and all this. And I remember leaving there. Now I've got the Pico Deli trays in the back seat because he handed them all to me. I've got the balloons going, the cake, everything. And I remember driving, and I stopped and called Rita, and I said, you know, he didn't give me a Christmas bonus. And she said, you asshole, you've just been fired. And he And he gave you a party, so you wouldn't be shamed. Like, he saved your dignity. Like, just stop, you know? It's like, I just, that arrogance got really big for me. And just going through that four-step and the rest, just that smashing of the ego, like in six, of like six and seven, like character building is not something I wake up to and think, whoa, what's coming my way? It's like, build my character today, you know? I'm not there. It's like, who can I duck and dive so I don't have to deal with people, you know? And like, even I have an office now in the back of our house. And like, even today, like, my husband comes in because it was my office day. And it's like, sweetie, what are you doing? And he's sitting there, and he's starting to doze off. I'm like, what are you doing? You're bringing me down. Get out. Like, this is my domain. Out. And Stephanie's like, oh, I just thought I'd help you. It's like, what? Anyway, okay. Anything else? My tense? Oh, gosh. I sure can. I can tell you a real fresh one. Last Tuesday night, I have this meeting Tuesday night in Glendale. I love my meeting. Denny spoke for me. I put a lot on this meeting, so of course now I'm doing, you know, 10 commitments and all this. No one's asked me. I just feel like I got to do it because the arrogance is coming out again. And so this woman, I had this interaction with this woman, and because the church has asked us not to give this other woman money because she's been becoming a nuisance and stuff. And so I was telling this lady, because she was about to do it, and I said, well, you know, the church has been asking us. And anyway, so we left it at that. I wasn't as quiet about it like I am right now telling you this, but I was just kind of, I get very forceful and still. And so we had the meeting. When I leave the meeting, I always call my husband, put my phone on when I get in the car, and I see if he needs me to pick up anything. And then, anyway, so there's this message from this lady, and she is just going to town on me. And I thought, whoa. My first thing is, oh, good, okay, good, it's okay, good. So my first thing is I want to call her back and say, you know, you should really talk to your sponsor before you go calling me and going off on me, you crazy thing. You know, and I just wanted to go, you know, and because I'm justified. Everybody calls her crazy and then her name. And so there's always one of those. And so I just now I'm like, I just want to go off. And I didn't. I parked the car. I said a little prayer. And I called her. She didn't answer. And but I left her a message. And I said, I'm very sorry for my behavior. I know I have a tone. I know I can be forceful. And I'm really glad that you called me on it and brought me down a few pegs. And I hope you hear this tonight so the rest of your night isn't so bad, because, you know, she had to leave the meeting and all this stuff, and I want to say, I'm not responsible, you know, I want to go off and all that. I did not. I stayed on my side. I stayed on my side. And, you know, I don't know, I was talking this with a friend, like, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe sitting and reading the literature and doing that, and then just, I don't know, having that open mind to just be able to let God come in. And for that night, I was just, I was being mean to one of God's kids, and I got called on it from a person I really don't even like. And God's messages don't always come in the way of from people we want it to come from. So I had to now just clean that up and take care of one of God's kids and go home and love my family, you know. So thank you. One more, Denny said. How do I practice principles in my marriage? This is what I do every morning when my husband gets up, because we have a lot of sense of humor and we laugh a lot about nothing in our house, and it's fun. I've learned that in sobriety I love to laugh. I really do. And sometimes it's hard, you know. So when my husband gets up, I always say, because I'm always up first, and I say, okay, you know, sweetie, God came down this morning, conferenced with me, and gave me the 411 on the day stuff. Anyways, and he'll say, you know, if you want the real answer, ask an old timer, because he's got a lot more time than me. So we just kind of do this little giggle and stuff. And I have two stepchildren, and when I first started dating my husband, he had them every other weekend and one night a week. And I thought, that's okay, because I don't like kids. And I really don't. They were little. They were like 4 and 5 and a half. And so they're needy. You know, they're a lot like newcomers. They need you. They ask a lot of questions. You don't know where their hands have been. I mean, it's just like, oh, my God. And then they just want to, like, hug you all the time. And it's like, get off me, you know. I'm going through a hot flash. Get off me, you know, kind of thing. And anyways, so I thought, okay, that's okay. And we were just dating at the time, and then he called me. It was April 2nd, 2008. I remember where I was standing on Beverly and Doheny. And he said, I'm now going to have my children full time because something happened with their mother. And I thought, wow. And then it was just the weirdest thing. This next thing came where it was, you know what? I am shoulder to shoulder with this man. And I know it's not going to be easy. And I really felt like this in my, the softness in my heart that I really love him and I love these kids. And that was weird because I really don't like kids. I never wanted them. Give me a pack of dogs. I'm good, you know, but not a stroller. And that's just me. It's good for you. If you want them, if you're going to come over, don't stay long. You know what I mean? That's just the thing. And, I've never changed a diaper, you know, none of that stuff. And anyway, so we've had a lot of a lot going on, you know. From they were like 6 and 7 when they came to live with him full time, and then we waited a year and got married, and now we're just shoulder to shoulder. Daniel. My stepson, he's 15. He's never been passionate about anything but the Xbox. And last summer, he got really passionate about football. And it was really weird because it's like, I didn't even know he knew what a football was. You know, like we don't watch in sports or anything. And he started playing football. He was in conditioning all summer and stuff. And just loving it. This kid's up at 4 a.m, is ready to go to Hell Week. You know, he'd be up and ready, you know, and just minutes. He was just itching to get out there. And then he wants to tell you about it and all these positions. And I just act like I acted when I was taking care of Deary. Like I'm interested in what he's saying. I don't know a thing about what he's talking about. And he wants to show me all this stuff on the TV. And I sit there and watch. Just like when he was little and wanted me to watch him play like these Lego things, you know. I do that. And I've realized that's love. You know, September, Daniel got hit really bad in practice, and he had a cerebral hematoma, and they had to do brain surgery on him and drain all the blood. And then this kid, he still wants to play football. You know, he still wants to play football. And Charlie and I, we're just like, you know, what do we do? So it's like, okay, you know what? We print out the piece of paper. We have to go to this doctor. We have to go to, you know, bring him into it to show him. You know, give him a little dignity. He's 15. He's almost 16. You know, he's becoming a young man. He's very mature. And you know, he's not going to be playing, but he doesn't know that just yet. And we're just kind of, we sat today and just was like, what do we do? And that's like our marriage. We just sit there. It's like, okay, what do we do with this and stuff? And we pray for this kid. I said, well, hope, you know, I wish they could find something for him to do, at least get him through the summer. Give him, you know, he's just, I hope he gets another passion. And anyways, I have to believe God has that path for him. So thank you for your question. I think that's it.